Welcome to the Sound of Economics podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. I'm Sean Gibson, and joining me today to discuss some key aspects of the EU budget are Lars Holgaard, former Deputy Director General at DG Agri, and Guntram Wolf, Director of Bruegel and co-author a research paper on the next EU budget. Guntram, in this new paper that you've co-written with Bruegel senior fellow Jolt Darvas, you find that Brexit and the emergence of new priorities in the EU will cause a shortfall in the budget. What areas will this shortfall be made up in?
Well, in this upcoming paper, we are basically looking at different scenarios of how the EU budget could develop. The starting point is that if everything continues business as usual, so we increase our spending and we increase our revenues roughly with national income, then the EU will have a budget shortfall for the period 21 to 27 of 94 billion euros. That is essentially a result of Brexit, because the United Kingdom is a major net contributor to the EU budget. Now, you can then think of various ways of how the budget could develop. We model two different scenarios. In one scenario, we basically freeze spending on the common agricultural policy, which is roughly a third of the current EU budget. And we freeze also the spending on cohesion and structural funds, which is another 40% or so of the EU budget. We freeze that in real terms, and so we basically let it increase only with inflation. Now, if you do that, you basically close quite a bit of the gap. You actually close the gap completely, but there's essentially no money left for what the European Commission now calls the so-called new priorities. Now, what are these new priorities? Well, these new priorities are essentially spending on immigration-related files, on border protection, on research and development, and on defense-related research. Digital transformation is another sort of big word that is used quite a bit. Now, if you look at how much these new priorities could cost us for a seven-year period, we can think again of different scenarios, and the European Commission does propose a number of different scenarios, and they range essentially in between what we spend currently, so that's, let's say, 200 billion for 7 years, and 600 billion for a seven-year period. Now, that's a lot of money, and so the question is, how do you get that kind of money? So one option is, of course, to increase revenues. So you go beyond the 1% of national income. Another option would be to freeze, not just in real terms, but actually freeze nominally the CAP and the cohesion fund, which would mean basically people receiving money in these two areas would make losses in real terms. And so that would be quite intrusive. So I guess that's sort of the modeling exercise. We also do have a literature review in which we sort of look at how effective is cohesion funding, how effective is common agricultural funding. And we show that in both cases, the literature does have quite a bit of negative things to say. So the evidence is not that these are great programs achieving all the aims they should be achieving. On the contrary, there's certainly room for improvement, which I think gives a little bit of a justification to at least freeze some of that spending in real terms. But still, I think in the end, an increase of the contributions from the member states will be necessary if we really want to attack and address these new priorities. And I think that's actually very important. So I think the EU budget will be 1.1% or more, not 1.0.
Lars, if we can come to you, what do you think should be done specifically regarding the CAP, the Common Agricultural Policy, in terms of reform?
Well, I think I need to start out by giving a little bit of the history and the reason why we are here today with the situation with high direct payments to farmers. When we started out the agricultural policy back in 1957, there was a question of harmonization between the different policies. And Germany, maybe people don't know that, had the high price level, and France had the low price level. And it's easier to harmonize upwards instead of downwards. So, in fact, we're still living with a legacy of the high German prices, which was the EU price level, resulting in high cost of production, because cereals is the brick in any production, and that kind of legacy we're still suffering from today. So we had a high price level up till 1992. McSherry then said, okay, we need to do something about this, also because of distortions, because of the WTO negotiations. So we switched from high prices to direct payments, which were still coupled. And then we went with official reform in 2013 to decouple the payments in order to not have a decision of the support being a decision for farmers in terms of what they produced, how much they produced, and in order to target more the questions of environment, biodiversity, etc. And now we're in a situation where the direct payments, being 100% financed by the EU budget, under so-called Pillar 1 measures, we have a problem of understanding from the side of the public what is the justification for having such high payments, which represent something like almost 40% of the whole total EU budget, whilst other sectors do not have that kind of income support. It must be said that the direct payments represent a very important part of farmers' income. Sometimes even up to 100%, but on average something like 40 to 50%. So my idea, my suggestion would be to, in order to justify high spending in agriculture, which I think is, there are good arguments to justify high spending, to switch from direct payments to target what I call public goods. So the principle should be public money for public goods. And I don't think the direct payments, the way they work today, can be characterized as a public good. But in order to give farmers the chance to adapt, you need to have them give them some time in terms of getting used to not having the direct payments. So you need a transition period. And this is something that we've always done in agricultural policy in order to allow farmers to get used to the new situation. And I don't know how long time you need, but I've said maybe 7 years, which is probably unrealistic. It's too short, but it's connected with the multi-annual financial framework period. If you need 15 years, so let it be. But we need to start a process of phasing out direct payments and using, if not all of the money, some of the money for the good purposes in terms of environment, in terms of climate change, in terms of biodiversity, in terms of animal welfare, in terms of organic farming, extensification. There are a number of areas which I think the general public would totally and absolutely accept that we use taxpayers' money for this purpose. And we need to underline that a lot of these objectives are not carried by the market price. The farmer is not remunerated over the market price for many of these activities which he has to deliver in terms of high standards. And I think there we need to do something about this. The question is, where do you set the basic line? Where do you say the minimum requirements where farmers are not paid, and where do you give them an additional payment for these extra public goods that you're asking farmers to deliver? I would add one more thing in terms of phasing out, which could be done, by the way, by the introduction of a so-called bond, a green bond. This would allow farmers to simply get the payments over a transition period. It would be phased down, the payments per year. And the farmer could choose to stick to that bond, but maybe he could also choose to sell the bond on the market, either to other farmers or in general to everybody. And that would allow him to get out of agriculture and perhaps leave the land to a younger farmer. Because the problem with direct payments is, amongst others, that it is capitalized into higher land value prices, which makes cost of production higher. So that would be a way of allowing the transition to younger farmers, which is a generational problem with many older farmers in agriculture, and that is something that we need to do something about. Another element, and we haven't talked about this, would be to consider the question of co-financing of the payments under Pillar 1, that is the direct payments. Today they're 100% financed by the EU budget, and that's probably the only real policy we have in the EU where we're talking about 100% financing by the EU budget. In order to make the member states more responsible in terms of what they put in place, like we do have it under the so-called Pillar 2 measures, that is rural development, climate, biodiversity, etc., an element of co-financing could be considered. Now, those who are against co-financing say, well, this will favor the richer member states because they have the money, whilst the poorer member states do not. Well, in order to accommodate that criticism, you could say the richer member states should pay a higher element or contribution on a national basis, and the poorer member states could get off the hook with lower percentages. Something of that kind of idea. A combination of phasing out of direct payments and co-financing would liberate funds for other purposes. Now, that's not something that's going to happen overnight. You need to have, as I said, a period of transition in order to let farmers adapt. So it's not the miracle that will help us in this present MFF discussion.
Lars, can I ask you perhaps to zoom in on a few points that you mentioned that were very interesting points? I mean, so one issue is this issue of the land price and the fact that the current direct payments basically lead to a higher price of land that makes it more difficult to transit to the next generation of farmers. Can you elaborate a bit more on how that works and what's the mechanism and how you would change that?
Well, the fact that the buyer of the land knows that he will get direct payments allows him, per definition, to pay a higher price. And this, of course, works in a way as a retirement scheme or a pension fund for the older farmer, because he can then use that capitalized value when he sells his land. So that's basic economics. It's a principle that we know as such when you know you get this type of payment.
So another point I wanted to ask you to explain a bit more to our listeners is this issue of public goods. I mean, so you mentioned public goods, biodiversity, green farming, and so on. Why is the current way of supporting farmers not conducive to achieving these goals that, by the way, are EU goals? And that I think have been also criticized by the European Court of Auditors as not being instrumental. These instruments have not been helpful in actually achieving these green goals that we have. And I think in the press there's a lot of reporting on things like dying insects, less and less insects because of industrialized agricultural way of doing farming in Europe. So why does it not currently work, and how can you really change it so that we will have again insects, higher amount of insects, more biodiversity, and so on? How would you change common agricultural policy?
I think we need to make this distinction between the so-called Pillar 1, the direct payments, decoupled direct payments, and the Pillar 2 with the co-financing and rural development measures. On the second pillar measures, I think basically we can say that they do a lot of good. They need, however, to be strengthened. And even with those measures, we see that there is a continuation of deterioration of soil conditions, biodiversity, the insects you mentioned. There's simply a need to reinforce, to strengthen those measures, which are good, but apparently not good enough, because we still have a situation of deterioration of water quality, pesticide overuse. So they are good measures, but we need to do more. The Pillar 1 In the reform of 2013, with the Commissioner Cholos at the time, introduced the so-called green element in direct payments. 30% of the direct payments in the future would be conditional on green farming. 70% would then be the basic continuation of payments as before. But the reality was that these 30% were so lax that they really didn't deliver anything additional. The principle of green payments was introduced, but the reality is that the effect was almost zero or even maybe negative, because farmers already could fully comply basically with this so-called 30% greening element. So that's very unfortunate, and that's an additional argument in need of phasing out, reworking the money that we have under the Pillar 1, transferring, if not all of it, to the second type of pillar measures, or if we want to continue with this distinction between Pillar 1 or Pillar 2, a reform CAP simply, which puts much more emphasis and focus on the public goods aspect. Now, I think there are other arguments also that can be said in terms of public goods, which is that we have farmers living in areas of the EU, in Scotland, in southern Italy, in northern countries, where the conditions for agriculture are extremely bad, where they really have no chance of being able to survive if we do not provide them with a substantial amount of less favored area kind of support, as we call them. And I think that's justified. I think that the public, taxpayers, would accept that we don't want to have just big farms concentrated in Central Europe, but we want to have a good balanced distribution of our farmers. And these farmers are not able to survive on the basis of market conditions. So I think that's justified to provide them with a kind of a direct support. So to come back to the Pillar 1 and the direct payments, today they are constructed in such a manner that they are supposed to deliver environmental benefits, greening element, but the reality is it doesn't at all, and therefore we need really to get them away, strengthen the policy, and put the emphasis on the so-called good types of measures.
So it's very good that we can discuss the full extent of desirable change that we that could be made to the cap, but Guntram, you've presented paper at a conference in Sofia, Bulgaria, and there are a lot of high-level ministerial attendees at this conference. How willing do you think the member states will be to embrace broad change with this MFF?
Well, I think my experience at that conference, as well as at our recent event when we had the EU Budget Commissioner, Mr. Oettinger, here, is that change is always difficult to manage and to achieve. Also because at the end of the day, the EU budget is decided by unanimity of the member states. And so that makes any significant change quite difficult. Now, I think there's certainly a lot of acknowledgement that we need to shift the balance and the priorities in the EU budget. We need to strengthen these new priorities. We need to have a strong innovation strategy. We need to be better on migration and border control. So that is, I think, quite widely shared. But as soon as it comes to the question, well, if we want to achieve those things, are we ready to sort of cut? It's getting much more difficult. So I think the only thing you can probably achieve is freezing spending in real terms. So meaning in real terms, common agricultural policy and cohesion more or less stays the same. But then, you know, you are basically in the game of having a larger budget, which is also very much resisted. So you are really having this clash again, which is of course a very unfortunate clash between the net payers and the net recipients in the EU budget. which in the end should make less and less sense, especially when we talk about these public goods. I mean, biodiversity, which we discussed a bit in this podcast, is something we share as a common goal. Protecting our common borders with European Frontex border guards is not about distributing money from country A to country B. I mean, this is really about creating something at the European level where we have sort of one new institution or new institutions that emerge and that do things better than each of us would do it individually. So I think at the end of the day, we need to overcome this net payer, net recipient logic. We probably will not do it, but perhaps we can go a little bit in that direction. And I think that's the real game that this discussion is all about. Will we move beyond the net payer logic? Will we add an element of perhaps our own resources, some own tax resources? That would be actually a very significant shift. Let's say issues like the emission trading system that generates revenues. Can we perhaps say, well, this is a European scheme. Why can the revenues from that scheme not be transferred into the EU budget instead of into national budgets? Can we think of perhaps a carbon tax at the EU level? Anything we could do in that direction, I think, would also help us get over this very unfortunate debate between the net creditors, which after Brexit are essentially Germany, Netherlands, France, and to some extent Italy, and the net recipients, which are essentially Eastern European countries and some Southern European countries.
Lars?
Well, I just wanted to add two things. One, when Commissioner Oettinger was here in Brügge last week, I had the chance to ask him a question about co-financing, and he said, well, that would still be taxpayers' money. Well, exactly. That would allow us to get a little bit away from the justa retour discussion, because that would mean that if you still have the 1% or 1.1% of GNI as the limit, it would liberate more money to others if it was nationally financed some of the direct payments. So I don't think his answer was very convincing in that sense, because it would actually de facto allow the EU to get more indirectly more money from the member states. The second thing I just wanted to add is that in relation to Brexit. Now, I don't think anybody would characterize Brexit as a good thing here in Brussels. But there's one interesting element I think I should add in this connection, and that is that the UK government, the Minister of Environment and Food, Michael Gove, has just recently here, end of February, published a document for a consultation where he actually argues that what we just talked about, the need to phase out the direct payments, and there are different models that he's talking about, and to convert that money, that sum of money, in fact, almost unlimited. He doesn't even talk about making savings, to convert that money into the so-called rural development type of measures, environment, climate change, etc. So it would be an interesting laboratory if, in fact, the UK went down that road and could demonstrate to the rest of the EU that this is viable. Of course, if it becomes a failure, that would only confirm those who would like to defend the status quo. I think it would be probably a success, because it would allow farmers to become competitive, it would pay for things that we want to have them to deliver, and it would make it politically much easier for us to defend the CAP, which, since I've been working on the CAP for all of my professional life, I would like to see. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Lars, and thank you, Guntram, for joining me. That brings us to the end of this episode of the podcast. If you're interested in any more of Brügge's work, you can visit our website, www.brügge.org. It's where we keep all our other blogs and research papers written by our scholars. I hope you'll join us again for the next episode of The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.